cloudy, hot, and humid. Rain and scattered thunderstorms. Some of the storms could have high winds, heavy rain, and hail. Today's high, 87. Heat index near 99 late in the afternoon. Right now, wind from the south-southeast at 14. This last band of rain now out over Lake Michigan. Humidity 93%, 70 degrees at 10 past 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com.
And we open today's Morning Show with a conversation with Stephanie Haynes, a writer for the Christian Science Monitor, whose work has appeared in all kinds of different publications. Her new book called White Man's Game, Saving Animals, Rebuilding Eden, and Other Myths of Conservation in Africa, takes a long, hard look at the long efforts of various forces and groups and individuals from the West trying to do good in the continent of Africa. Efforts which perhaps are laudable in many respects, but often which have unintended consequences. At one point, she calls it the pitfalls of best intentions. And we're going to talk with Stephanie Haynes about some of the concerns that she raises in her very, very thought-provoking book, which is published by Metropolitan Books, a division of Henry Holt & Company. Stephanie Haynes, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Oh, thanks so much.
So you draw some very, very interesting parallels between some of the present-day activity of the West in Africa with events from the more distant past, particularly the whole phenomenon of Western explorers, in a sense, bumbling into the continent, thinking that they were equal to its challenges and mysteries, and, of course, in so many cases, falling prey to a very, very tragic end. Explain how that has something to do with some of these modern stories that you tell. What is the connection there?
Sure. We have a great long history of adventure stories in Africa. And a lot of those started with these explorers of the 1700s, 1800s, people who would leave their comfortable homes in Europe and then travel into this dark and dangerous place and then come back sometimes with these fantastic stories of scary people and scary nature and beauty and danger. And it has turned into a narrative that we still are living in a lot of ways. If you look at any of the, whether it's National Geographic or whether it's the brochures from different aid organizations, we see a lot of those same themes. Or even tourism. There's a lot of this come for your adventure in Africa. And I think that storyline, which is really deep in our consciousness in the West, impacts a lot of how we interact with different parts of Southern Africa.
In some ways, at the beginning of the story where you talk about the importance of story and of the narratives that we create in our own minds, you say the stories we tell dramatically affect our actions. And in a sense, what you're saying is when we sort of tell the story of Africa to ourselves, either as individuals or collectively as a culture, we are telling that story in a way that is, in a sense, very slanted and gives us an incomplete picture. In particular, you talk repeatedly in your book about how we like to think of the continent as vulnerable Africa, a vulnerable Africa in need of our help. The trick there, of course, is that there are ways in which the continent is vulnerable and facing a lot of problems. Is there a way for us to acknowledge the needs of many of the people of that continent without sort of slipping past this line into a frame of thinking that you are uncomfortable with?
Sure, I think there is, and definitely I agree that we don't just close ourselves off from the world. We don't say, I'm sorry, forget everybody, it's too complicated. I think what we need to do is realize that it is much more complex than we often paint it as being, and also realize that there is a lot of expertise on the ground. And so you can offer help, but you should be willing to accept the thanks, but no thanks. We should also not treat people as being lesser than. This idea that we need to go and uplift the Africans is another long part of our story. And even though some of the wording has changed, a lot of that white man's burden narrative still exists. And I think that we can say and we can offer different types of assistance. We can maybe start with what people ask for. We can try to support perhaps more than we treat, more than going in as a sort of a charity mission. So I do think there are ways to help, but I think the first step probably goes back a little bit further and starts with really listening and really building an honest and equal cross-cultural community. Hmm. And that's something that we're not really good at. We're not really good at it within our country, and we're not particularly good at it internationally. And so I think that that's the first step.
One of the most interesting pictures you paint is how a lot of the philanthropic work of the West in Africa has changed in sort of tenor and tone over the last 20 years, that we have seen, actually, you say, a dramatic drop or decline in unrestricted giving and much more attention given to very focused giving, and often at the behest of a specific celebrity or someone with great wealth who really wants to tackle a problem and sort of has their own framework within which they want to see this change carried out. You call it at one point, or it's called philanthrocapitalism or social entrepreneurship. What are the most common pitfalls that we are seeing when this kind of activity takes place?
Yeah, so this is something that we're seeing internationally and also nationally. People who work for nonprofits within the U.S. have probably seen the similar thing, where a lot of wealthy people, a lot of givers, don't really want to just hand their money over to some other large foundation or some university. They want to really target where it's going. And it ties in with this idea that people can be change makers both in business and in social causes. And so people really want to have like their cause. They want to come up with the solutions. They want to create their own project. And besides the problem of reinventing the wheel a lot, which is one issue with it, you end up having a lot of these efforts wrapped up with particular individuals. So when I was reporting in Southern Africa, and I tell some of this in White Man's Game, my book, you have people who start off very positively, and they have a lot of energy, they have a lot of capital, they have a lot of great ideas, they have a lot of friends. And then if something blows up in their lives, or if something doesn't quite work that fits with their personal mission, the whole project can start to crumble. And that's certainly not every case. There are other cases that I write about where that hasn't happened. But it, when we tie so much with the power of one individual to make change, then all of a sudden a lot of the work has the potential for unraveling.
Right. You spend a lot of time in your book talking about one such wealthy individual by the name of Greg Carr. Explain briefly the project to which he has devoted so much time and money.
Sure, and I should clarify that he's in the category of one that hasn't unraveled because of him.
Right.
He is a human rights philanthropist and former businessman who is connected to Harvard University, and he became very interested in humanitarian issues and decided that he wanted to try to find some place where he could help in Southern Africa. And after thinking about it for a long time, he decided that what he wanted to do was to work in the southeastern African country of Mozambique and use a national park or a natural area to be an economic engine to bring at least some part of the country up to a middle-class level of living. And he found this park that had been destroyed in Mozambique's long civil war called the Gorongosa National Park. And he decided that this was going to be his place. He was going to try to rebuild this park, give jobs and other economic opportunities to the surrounding community, and use this one park to make very impoverished central Mozambique a middle-class society. And I was lucky enough to be there fairly close to the beginning of that project, and I followed it for a number of years, including 1 year where I was there for pretty much the whole year reporting about it, not there in the park the whole year, but reporting about it, either there or around it or doing research from South Africa. And it was a fascinating effort, and it was one that really showed me the complications and pitfalls of even the best, most well-thought-out, well-intentioned efforts.
Right. Among the things you point out that are at the heart of this story and a couple other stories you tell is that what you describe, again, this is in describing another situation and in a similar sort of effort in Africa, you describe a devastating dichotomy between the needs of people and the needs of nature. That sometimes when we are swooping in and trying to save a species of animal or something, unknowingly, we are actually complicating the lives of the people who live there in unintended fashion. And while that might not be exactly the story of Greg Carr, that kind of points to the sort of thing that can happen when somebody from the West steps in and is trying to make radical change.
Absolutely. I write of one man who was employed by Greg Carr's project, the Gorongosa National Park, and it was this great, well-intentioned effort to give people jobs in the park that would give them another source of livelihood. They wouldn't have to poach anymore. They would realize that a functional ecosystem was better for them than one that was dying. And they gave this guy a job in the park. He ended up, after his contract was done, going back to the same sanctuary that he had been building for animals and killing some of those animals for food and to sell the meat. He ended up being arrested as a poacher and put into work duty for a number of months. He was away from his family. It was just sad. The whole thing was just really tragic. And you saw how even this well-intentioned program to this one man was yet another instance of outsiders coming in and really manipulating and hurting his family. And that's hard. I mean, it's a hard question, and it's a hard issue to get around. So I think what you said is absolutely true. People can come in, and with the best intentions, it's a great vision to have this utopia where people and animals are all going to live together and be really happy. But when we come in from the outside without the historical understanding, without the cultural intimacy that would be great if we did have, you can make these mistakes that cut very deeply.
Right. And you're quick to say that in your book, you are not giving us the complete picture of this entire continent. You are giving us glimpses, many different glimpses of what is going on in Africa, some of which should give us pause. And you pose the question, is what we're doing there out of its genuine sense of love thy neighbor, or is this at its heart more of a thirst for adventure? Or are we distracting ourselves from our own social ills here at home? As you wrote this book, did you have any concern that you might be in some way hurting those genuine efforts? I mean, those efforts that are maybe better grounded in Africa. If we read a book like this and sort of pull away from any attempts at all to help the people of Africa, were you worried at all about that risk?
wasn't. I think that with this book, what I really call for is a deeper and more honest understanding of other people. And I think there are ways to do that. I am definitely not saying with this book that we should turn our backs on an entire continent with all the incredible diversity of people and places and problems and hopes that are there. I think what I hope people get from this book is this idea that we can build a different type of community. We can take a step back, and instead of saying, how do we save these people? How do we save this animal? How do we save this place? How do we go back to that more humble and more fundamental question of how do we all live in this world? And I think from there, we can start having a different type of dialogue, whether it's between people here and in different parts of Africa, or whether it's even within our own country, starting to build the tools to understand our own stories and then try to understand and honor other people's stories. I think if we start doing that, that's not turning our backs. That's just starting to rebuild, kind of take down some of these old storylines that we've had that I really do think have hindered our efforts to help, and start re-scaffolding something that's healthier. Mm. So I think if there are people who are doing that in Southern Africa or Central Africa or anywhere, I don't think that they would be threatened by this book. I think that they would see this as saying a lot of things that they already know. And I hope that it's a framework that people could use to do hopeful things going forward.
The book is White Man's Game, Saving Animals, Rebuilding Eden, and Other Myths of Conservation in Africa, published by Metropolitan Books. Stephanie Haynes, thank you so much for writing this powerful and thought-provoking book.
Oh, thanks so much, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye. The time is exactly 8:27. And you're listening to the music, morning show for Thursday on WGTD. And part two is coming up in just a moment.
Sometime recently, I noticed a cute comic strip in the newspaper. The comic strip Mutts, which I'm sure many of you see. In this particular case, it wasn't one of those cute little dogs. It was two birds sitting on a tree branch. And one of the birds in the first panel says, well, it's time to fly north. And then they just sit there silently in the second panel. In the third panel, the second bird just turns to his friend and says, why? And, of course, that question is one which is actually in some ways more intriguing and mysterious than you might think. In fact, we are still trying to unlock exactly what goes on with the migration of animals. And it occurs across the globe on a whole range of scales. I mean, from massive migrations over many hundreds or even thousands of miles to migrations which are much briefer, a matter of sometimes feet or even inches. And yet it is still this need and drive for animals to take themselves from place to place for different reasons. And it is something which is also, to some extent at least, in peril due to some of the ways in which we have reshaped the planet and changed different habitats. And that is what is explored in a book called No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations. And the author is David Wilkove, Professor of Ecology, Evolutionary Biology, and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Perhaps you have seen his book, The Condor's Shadow, The Loss and Recovery of Wildlife in America. And this newest book helps us understand the mystery and the miracle that is animal migration, and also the way in which this is being disrupted in some very ominous ways. The book is published by Island Press. And Professor David Wilkove, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have to say real briefly that I'm intrigued by what you teach at Princeton, ecology, evolutionary biology, and public affairs. That is an interesting and, I should think, probably rather crucial mix.
That's right. I'm trained as a scientist, but I'm deeply interested in how we can use science to affect public policy, and in particular, how we can take a scientific approach to addressing many of our environmental problems.
Tell us about this, in general, this intriguing phenomenon of, as you put it in the introduction, animals on the move.
Migration is found across the world, and every type of creature migrates. Birds, butterflies, fish, great whales, antelopes. It's a very successful strategy. It allows animals to get to places where there are abundant food resources or other things that they can take advantage of, provided they get out before conditions get bad. So a songbird can come up to Wisconsin in the summer, feast on all the insects, but it better get out before the snow comes. And that strategy has worked wonderfully for millions of years. But as people alter their environment, as people change the planet, it becomes increasingly difficult for migratory species of all types to complete their journeys. And that's bad news for them, it's bad news for the environment, it's bad news for us.
Hmm. I want to, as we just explore this phenomenon of animals on the move, I wonder if you would contrast for our listeners the amazing story, for instance, of the Arctic tern, and then the story of migration with these tiny little shrimp-like crustaceans known as krill. I mean, I think in some ways these are opposite ends of the spectrum, and it's fascinating to think of them being, in a sense, sort of the same phenomenon on vastly different scales.
Sure. So the Arctic tern may be the champion bird traveler. It nests up in the Arctic and migrates down to the Antarctic. So it really circles the globe, a round-trip journey that would be measured on the order of probably 20,000 miles. It spends most of its life on the move. In contrast, in the Antarctic, these krill, they engage in a daily migration where they come up towards the surface of the water, and then they migrate down, and they're catching the sunlight. And that little migration that they make every day is, of course, the basis for the whole food chain in the Antarctic, everything from the fish to the penguins, the great whales. And so you have two very different sorts of migration by completely different sorts of animals, and it illustrates just how unusual and interesting animal migrations are.
Hmm. You tell us that this movement of animals occurs for different reasons, for the search for food or shelter, patrolling one's territory, plain old dispersal across a wider area. But then, of course, there is this thing which we think of or that you call classic migration. Explain to us exactly what that is.
Classic migration is the bird that nests up in Wisconsin in the summer, migrates to a winter home in Central America, and then in the spring returns to Wisconsin. It's that round-trip ticket. And that's the migration that a lot of animals take, and it's one that is becoming an increasingly difficult journey for all sorts of species.
Hmm. You say that there is some real mystery surrounding just exactly why animals migrate the way that they do. I mean, that sometimes it at least on the surface seems to be rather puzzling behavior, or maybe in other cases amazing in what they are able to accomplish, or why they migrate exactly the way they do. Just give us a couple of the most intriguing examples, if you would.
I think my favorite example is the monarch butterfly. So all of the monarch butterflies that we see in the late summer in eastern North America are migrating towards a very small area in the mountains of central Mexico where they will winter in these high-elevation fir forests. In the spring, the monarchs that have made it through the winter will fly north. They'll get to the Gulf states in the southeast. They'll lay their eggs, and they'll die. Those eggs will ultimately develop into monarch butterflies, and those monarchs will fly north a little farther, lay their eggs, and die. Their children, in turn, will continue the journey north, and so this goes on for several generations. And then, by the time it's the late summer, the monarchs have repopulated eastern North America, and the great-grandchildren of the original monarchs turn around and make it all the way back to those very same mountains in Mexico. So it's a migration that takes place over many generations, and we really don't understand how they do it. Somehow encoded in their genes is the ability to turn around and four or five generations later find a few isolated mountaintops in Mexico.
Yeah, I love the way you put this. You say there are two mysteries to be solved. What navigational tricks do the monarchs employ to reach their winter quarters? And what environmental cues or genetic program allows them to produce multiple generations of northward-bound butterflies before producing a generation that reverses course and heads to Mexico? I mean, that is incredibly intriguing. And one wonders if we're ever going to be able to unlock that intriguing question.
I'm hopeful that we will be able to. Our ability to study migratory animals has improved so much over the past couple decades. It allows us to do things we never thought we could do. Some colleagues and I were involved in an experiment a couple years ago where we attached tiny radio transmitters to the bellies of dragonflies, and we tracked them as they migrated along the East Coast. We were in cars or airplanes. The dragonflies were migrating south. That sort of thing would have been inconceivable not too long ago, but the technology is at the point where we can begin to unlock some of these secrets.
I was really fascinated as you tell the story of the monarch butterfly that it was such an enormous mystery until, I think you say, 35 years ago. Only then did we start to really track this carefully and really understand where they were going and how this was all working. I think most people would have just assumed that a question like that, which has intrigued people for a long time, would have been solved long before that.
No, it wasn't until the 1970s that people finally discovered the winter home of the monarch butterfly. And they had been thinking that the butterflies might be in the southeastern United States or maybe in the tropics. Or some people thought they were engaged in this pointless lemming-like march out into the Gulf of Mexico. But it turns out that by attaching little white numbered tags to monarchs and then asking people to report where they saw them, they could develop a map that showed that most of the monarchs seemed to be funneling into Mexico. And with a couple more years of searching in the late 1970s, they finally discovered this handful of mountaintops where all of the monarchs congregate, and the trees are literally covered in butterflies. It's an amazing sight.
I count myself very, very fortunate to have stumbled upon not that sight exactly, but something like it in a large, large group of monarch butterflies in southwest Iowa, where I lived at the time. I just happened to be walking through the city park and just happened upon hundreds and hundreds of monarch butterflies gathered on a group of trees there, clearly on their way. I don't remember if it was down south or back north or something, but it was an amazing sight, and of course, you multiply that by I don't know how much, and we try to imagine what the sight is down in Mexico, where they all gather by the thousands, maybe millions. You say, though, that with the discovery of this has come tourists and the necessity to guard monarch butterflies from our injurious intrusion on them.
The biggest threat to of the monarch butterflies, which I discuss at some length in No Way Home, is logging of those forests. Unfortunately, a lot of illegal logging is going on. In fact, just a couple days ago, the NASA, the space agency, released satellite photographs showing continued logging in the winter sanctuary of the monarch butterflies.
Well, and you say these, some of this illegal logging is done by heavily armed crime syndicates. I mean, they are formidable, and they are not giving this up easily.
That's correct. They are determined to cut the trees, and thus far, the efforts of the Mexican government to protect the winter sanctuaries of the monarch have not been all that successful. So there's a very real possibility that if the winter home of the butterfly isn't protected, some spring there will just not be that great migration of monarchs back to the United States and Canada.
We're speaking with David Wilkove about his book, No Way Home. You describe most migratory phenomenon as involving, first of all, opportunism, that the animals are trying to take advantage of a greater resource someplace else, and that secondly, there is some sense of vulnerability in most animals as they migrate. You go on to talk about how migration is threatened by a number of different things, and that also that migration by its very nature is itself kind of a vulnerable phenomenon. Before we talk about the specific threats, describe to our listeners what that last part is, the fact that migration being this sort of multi-level journey is vulnerable to disruption all along the way.
That's right. A migratory animal needs a place to breed, a place to spend the winter, and it needs sufficient stopover sites so that it can rest and refuel during its journey. And that means we have to have a coordinated, comprehensive conservation effort to protect all those areas. If we don't do that, if we break any chain in that journey, we could lose the migratory species. And that's what makes migratory animals so challenging to protect.
They need to have a safe place to live, a safe destination, and they need to be safe all along that journey. What are the most pervasive or common disruptions which we are seeing right now?
Probably the most widespread threat to migratory animals today is habitat destruction, because they can be harmed by inappropriate development along any part of their migratory route or at either ends of the journey. But another big threat turns out to be over-exploitation. Many of these migratory animals, the ones we like to harvest, travel in large herds or flocks, or in the case of salmon, they all funnel up a river. And so before we had sensible laws to regulate fishing, people would stretch nets across the entire mouth of a river and catch every single salmon that came upstream to spawn. And then looming on the horizon, a threat that we're just beginning to understand, is global climate change.
What is especially fascinating and troubling about this is the fact that especially those animals which migrate over any significant distance are doing so without regard to political borders. I want to just read a brief little portion here where you talk about this. You say that add to all of these challenges the political hurdles that conservationists face in attempting to protect migratory species, the primary one being geography. Migratory animals cross national borders with abandon. It's part of their appeal. But those same borders demarcate independent agencies, institutions, and cultures that somehow must coordinate their conservation efforts if the species is to prosper. In an increasingly fractious world, that is no small task. Maybe you can give us one concrete example of this and of the kind of cooperation that would be necessary for a given species and its migratory practices to be safeguarded?
Certainly. One of the more successful efforts involves migratory waterfowl, ducks and geese. And in that case, many of them breed in Canada, and they winter in either the United States or Mexico. And for a number of years now, there has been a treaty between the United States, Canada, and Mexico to coordinate the protection of waterfowl habitat. And much of the money to protect and restore wetlands for these birds has come from a tax that was placed on the sale of ammunition and hunting supplies and things like that. So you have the three governments working together to try to ensure that the habitats of these waterfowl are protected. And at the same time, there is this secure source of funding that the hunting community has supported. And it's certainly true that we are seeing continued declines in some waterfowl species, but there's also been a tremendous success, and millions of acres of waterfowl habitat have been protected or restored. Now there's talk of doing something similar. There's initiatives underway to achieve the same level of cooperation and coordination to protect migratory songbirds, which undertake similar journeys.
You point out that it is tough enough to protect a migrating animal that migrates within the borders of a single nation. But when animals migrate across those kind of borders, it's then we're calling for a still more complicated and trickier level of cooperation. And although it's not happening to the extent that conservationists would want, you do point to these examples where that has, to some extent at least, occurred, giving us at least some hope that maybe it can continue to this kind of cooperation can be nurtured.
I think that's right. I think we can be optimistic. It's going to take work. It's going to take a level of cooperation and interest that we haven't always shown, but there's no doubt that migratory species can be helped. I'll give you an example. In the United States, one conservation organization, the American Bird Conservancy, has gotten its supporters in the United States to raise funds to protect a forest in Colombia that is an important winter home for the cerulean warbler, one of our prettiest and least common songbirds. And the membership of the American Bird Conservancy recognizes that for there to be cerulean warblers in the United States in the summer, there has to be a winter home for them in South America. Or, to give you another example, the gray whale on the Pacific coast was once hovering at the brink of extinction because of whaling. It has been protected. The special lagoons in Mexico where they give birth to their young are being protected and guarded. And as a result, the gray whale has staged a remarkable recovery and is probably as common today as it was 300 years ago.
That gives us cause for hope. I want to finish by just reading the very end of the book where you remind us that in a sense, the animal that migrates is acting on instinct and in a sense, in an act of faith. That instinct tells the bird it is time to go, time to venture hundreds or thousands of miles to some other place where living conditions will be better for the next few months, as has been the case for generations upon generations of its ancestors. The bird travels without any knowledge of what may have happened to its breeding grounds, its wintering grounds, or any of the places in between since the last time it made the journey. It just goes. In that respect, perhaps migration is an act of faith, after all, a hardwired belief that there is somewhere to go and a way to get back. The book is called No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations. It is published by Island Press. And Professor David Wilcove, I thank you so much for writing this fascinating and important book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And for part three of today's Morning Show, you'll hear my conversation with author Mark Adams, his intriguing book called Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City, which is really the story of Mark Adams exploring the wide range of people who have explored the legend of Atlantis and, with varying degrees of seriousness, searched for it. You described at one point in the book how Atlantis is a virus and that you had been exposed. Briefly tell our listeners how you were first exposed to the so-called Atlantis virus.
Well, what happened was I was assigned a magazine story to write about the greatest philosophers of all time. And after calling about 10 professors, every single one of them said the greatest philosopher of all time was Plato. So I started reading a little bit of Plato, and I came across again and again this piece of information I couldn't wrap my head around, which was that everything we know about Atlantis comes from two dialogues that Plato wrote around 360 BC.
And what was it about that that was so intriguing that you just couldn't shake it off?
Well, here on the one hand, we've got, you know, this sort of idea that's usually associated with crackpot ideas, you know, with Bigfoot and UFOs and things like that. And
or comic books.
Hand, exactly, and, you know, Scrooge McDuck. And here on the other hand, we've got the greatest thinker in Western history. So the idea that those two places met somewhere in the world, I found absolutely fascinating.
Hmm. So there is this whole field, a growth industry, you call it, of Atlantology.
Yeah.
And I suppose that, tied into what you just said, it is probably a really complicated landscape in which you indeed do have crackpots, but also people who do work on this with the utmost seriousness and in some cases even scientific criteria in mind. Just tell us about just how wide a range we're talking about in this universe of Atlantis explorers.
Well, you know, on the one end, you've got people who follow psychic visions and you know, believe that they lived in Atlantis in past lives. And on the other end, you've got serious scientists. As you know, probably the most esteemed Atlantologist in the world is a fellow who's a geophysicist at one of the best universities in Greece, who's using all sorts of data to look for it. You know, one of the more interesting theories I found was a guy who took all of these details that Plato put in the Atlantis story. And there is a lot of specific detail, which is what makes the search for Atlantis so enticing. And, you know, he put it through a statistical analysis and figured out that Plato's Atlantis had been in Morocco. So, you know, there's all kinds of different levels of people looking for this.
Give us a rough idea of the kind of city that was described by Plato. And what makes that description so exceptionally compelling?
Well, Plato describes a maritime city that is shaped like three concentric rings of land and water. I think if anyone is ever going to actually find the original source for Atlantis, they're going to have to find those three concentric rings. It's a very militaristic society. They're at war with Athens. That's the actual story of Atlantis. They have this enormous plain behind the city where all the food is grown. They have this incredible system of canals. They have a large mountain range to the north that supposedly blocks these northerly winds. You know, he really gets into this sort of granular detail that makes you want to go out and look for this thing if you read the original story.
The fourth chapter of the book, this is your search for various folks pursuing this takes you all over the world, actually. At this point in this chapter, I think you're somewhere in Ireland.
Yeah.
But at one point you mention that it's really difficult for anyone who is maybe a serious scientist or academic to raise serious questions about this because you're so often prone to ridicule. At one point you write, "I couldn't blame academics for being wary. Any online search for information about Atlantis quickly sucks one into a wormhole of conspiracy theories and magic portals to untapped dimensions." I'm sure that must have been both a complicating factor for you and also a source of endless fascination in the writing of this book.
Well, of course, that sort of thinking is fascinating. But when you're trying to get, you know, actual academics and scholars on the phone, you have to hold off on using the A word at first, because they'll just hang up on you. There were a lot of emails that went unanswered once people got around to the fact that I was talking about Atlantis. It just, for certain fields, it seems to be career kryptonite to even raise the topic, because it's been, you know, tarnished by this association with crazy thinking. Hmm.
In what way would you equate your escalating fascination with all of this as akin to what drives those who really believe there was an Atlantis and find this, feel this urge to somehow discover it or uncover yet undiscovered facts about it? I mean, in a sense, is their obsession and your obsession one and the same?
I think by the end they were pretty similar. We're both basically following the treasure map that Plato laid out and trying to get to that buried treasure. And, you know, by the end, you know, I come up with some conclusions based on what I think Plato was trying to do with this story. But, you know, when you look at all these details that he gives and you start to dig through it and try to find that original kernel of truth, it does become absolutely, you know, obsessive. It just takes over your whole life at a certain point.
Hmm. So what do you think is what is going on in the minds of particularly people who are otherwise serious and sane human beings who find themselves gripped with this this belief? And I guess I don't mean the people who also believe the world is flat or believe witches or whatever, but I mean those who are really serious about this. What is so intriguing about the notion of a place called Atlantis?
Well, you know, as one archaeologist explained to me, you know, Atlantis, we've come to believe it was some sort of utopia, and we project these, you know, whatever feelings we have onto this place. We think it was, you know, peaceful, or we think it was, you know, super sophisticated. I think for these people, it's just the idea of, like, solving a mystery. You know, perhaps the greatest mystery of all time. Was Atlantis real? And if it was, where was it located?
Hmm. To that last question, let's just chat about that for a second.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, we're giving serious thought to where is Atlantis located, when in fact there may not have ever been an Atlantis.
Very true.
But that being said, what are the current best estimates of where one might find the ruins of Atlantis if they existed?
I would say the original source of Plato's Atlantis was probably one of four places. It was probably either in southern Spain, just outside the Pillars of Hercules at Gibraltar there, or on the island of Malta, which is the oldest culture in the Mediterranean, has the oldest freestanding temples in the Mediterranean. There's an island off of Greece called Santorini, which has a sort of unique bullseye shape, which Plato says the city of Atlantis had. And then there's a spot on the Atlantic coast of Morocco near the city of Agadir, which, you know, according to a statistical analysis that this IT professional in Germany did, is like, he called it Seven Sigma, the way it measured up. The numbers were so good. So I would say it's probably one of those four places.
Hmm. Do you find yourself, now you have written this book, with your thirst to know more about Atlantis quenched? Or in some ways, is this a virus that one never fully sheds?
You know, I don't think you could fully shed this virus until it were proven definitively either that Atlantis was fiction or that Plato had based it on an actual story. And I think it's more likely the latter, and I think that it's still possible that we'll come up with some new piece of evidence that will completely change the search for Atlantis.
In our last few seconds, tell our listeners about one of the many fascinating characters that you met on the road to this adventure.
Well, probably the most fascinating character I met on the road to Atlantis was Tony O'Connell, who operates an online encyclopedia called the Atlantipedia, out of his house in the least populated part of Ireland. Because no academics will take this seriously, Tony has become sort of a clearinghouse for all the ideas about Atlantis. And he's an arbitrator who gets to decide, you know, what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. And he's kind of given his whole life over to this. He's a great guy.
Hmm. One of many memorable characters we meet in the pages of your fascinating book. Again, it's called Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City, published by Dutton. Mark Adams, congrats on a fascinating and very fun book.
Thank you very much.